Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. One of my favorite sayings is that a change is as good as a rest. It captures an idea I found true in my own life, that doing something different, even if it takes effort, is just as rejuvenating, and in fact more so, than doing nothing. Well, my guest today would tweak this maxim slightly to say that change is a rest. His name is Alex Soojung Kim Pong, and he's a writer, consultant, and academic, as well as the author of Rest, Why You Get More Done When You Work Less. We begin our conversation with why many people feel overworked in the modern age, how quality rest is an antidote, and how Alex defines rest as something that can be active rather than passive and even thought of as a skill. We discuss why rest is valuable, even with seemingly unstrenuous knowledge work, and how apparently unproductive mind wandering can in fact make you more productive and creative. Alex shares how many hours of focused cognitive work you're really capable of putting in each day, and how successful people tend to set up their daily routine, including why it's effective to stop work each day in the middle of a task. We also discuss why you want to layer periods of rest and work in your schedule, how hobbies offer a sense of autonomy that's crucial in making rest refreshing, and how exercise plays a key role in recovery from work, even amongst brainy intellectuals. Along the way, Alex shares insights in the lives of eminent men like Eisenhower, Hemingway, and Viktor Frankl, and how to get better rest, become better at your craft, and lengthen the longevity of your career. After the show's over, check out our show notes at aom.is/rest. All right, Alex Soojung Kim Pong, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks very much for having me.
So you've written a book called Rest, which addresses the problem of overwork. And we might think this is a modern problem. This has been a problem in America going back a long time. You point out in the book that guys like William James were writing about the problem of overwork in America back in the 19th century. But in many ways, people today seem just more burnt out than ever compared to the past. What's behind that? What do you think is going on there?
The more proximate causes for our current epidemic of burnout, first of all, are that we have these models of success that really derive from the 70s and 80s and the explosion of high tech and the finance industries, where we had this new vision of American success, where you became rich and successful, not by paying your dues and working your way up the ladder, but by spectacular disruptive moves that you could only pull off when you're brilliant and young and obsessed and lucky. At the same time, we've also had a kind of erosion of job and career stability and career ladders that have, for all the rest of us, put pressures on us to work more, less by choice than by necessity, or in order to demonstrate our, you know, indispensability to our employers. And then we've also, you know, moved from economic activity, where productivity was easily measurable, to work that's harder to evaluate. And in that environment, time in the office has become a proxy for productivity and commitment. And then finally, we've had information technologies that have allowed us to now carry our offices around in our pockets, allowing work to spread out to colonize more of our time. So that's a complicated answer, but I think that the reason it's worth diving into that is to show that, you know, the problem with overwork is one that consists of a whole bunch of really gigantic interconnected parts. And so, you know, as a result of all of this complicated stuff, not only is leisure devalued, you know, not only do we have less time for rest in our daily lives, but even the concept of leisure gets devalued as something that is worth pursuing or is worth rewarding.
And you use your book to argue for the real value of leisure, of rest. And we'll get to that here in a bit. But before we do, based on your research, how do you define rest?
You know, well, I think fundamentally, you know, rest is time we spend recovering the mental and physical energy that we spend sort of working, usually for a wage, usually for someone else. And, you know, in the everyday sense, we tend to think of rest as something that's entirely passive, right? It's something that you do with a remote in one hand and like a bag of snacks in the other. But, you know, when I was writing the book, I realized that actually, you know, while that has its place, rest is actually something rather more complicated. You know, for one thing, there's a lot of rest that is active. First of all, there's a lot going on at the level of cellular or brain repair when we sleep or when we're just like, you know, sort of lying around. But activities like exercise, like walking, that are active are actually very mentally and psychologically restorative. You know, another thing I realized was that rest is actually a skill. It's something that we can get better at over time, and we can learn how to integrate it into our daily schedules to both increase recovery and, you know, to boost creativity. And a lot of history's most famously creative and prolific people learned to do exactly that.
So let's talk about what rest does for us. I think the assumption is that most people has like, well, if you work more, you're going to be more productive and it's just, you're going to get more done. Particularly with mind work, office work. If you're a farmer, like working hard all the time, you obviously, you know you have to take a break. You're just physically exhausted.
Right.
Office work, it's not so much. So what does the research say? Like, what happens to our bodies, our brains, whenever we take a step back from the keyboard and just decompress and take some rest?
Yeah, you know, I think first off, you are exactly right that we underestimate just how physically demanding and taxing knowledge work is. The brain actually turns out to be really a very greedy consumer of oxygen and sugar. And so it's, you know, so serious mental work can be as draining as sort of physical labor, just in a different sort of way. But what science tells us now is that during downtimes, sort of mentally what goes on is when you like clear your head and sort of zone out and try and think of nothing, it's actually not the case that your brain just sort of shuts off. What happens is that it shifts modes from sort of conscious mode to something that neuroscientists call the default mode network, which is a series of connections between parts of the brain, particularly ones that involve like visual thinking and creativity. And what's interesting about this is that the default mode network seems to be the thing that is or like working on your behalf when you are, you know, when you suddenly solve problems that had eluded your conscious effort. So this is something actually that we see every day, right? You're trying to remember the name of the actor who is in the movie and the TV show and that other thing, and their name is on the tip of your tongue. And then 5 minutes later, you're doing something else and oh, it pops into your head. That's the default mode network continuing to work on problems even when your attention has shifted elsewhere. And it turns out that especially in areas where you've studied really hard, you're well trained, the default mode network is capable of doing pretty amazing things in those areas. And the effect, its ability is powerful enough so that some people organize their daily routines so that they can have these alternating periods of really focused work and then these periods of mind wandering so that there is, and this is sort of a key to understanding how it is that they're able to be both highly productive and highly creative. They're making use of both of these periods in a way that also gives them more downtime, more rest time, and lets them live kind of happier and more sustainable lives.
But if you're checking your email at night or over the weekend and doing like that, you're not letting you can't access that default network as well as you could have if you just completely stepped away.
Exactly. No, you need stuff like, you know, basically when you're doing stuff like sort of email, social media checks, it doesn't, you know, for most of us, it does not provide the sort of level of disengagement that, let's say, you know, going for a walk or doing something else to clear your head does. That really is a lot closer to kind of low value cognitive activity. But I think really, you know, something where you are able to space out a little bit, where you can really kind of let your attention go, is the zone where the default mode is able to take over and, you know, able to work its magic.
So doing something that looks unproductive can actually make you more productive because you can get more insights that could just lead to big gains in some area of your work.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that sort of the, you know, you see these stories of like mathematicians or composers who have these, you know, amazing moments of insight, you know, these aha moments. And it turns out that, you know, there's almost always, when you widen the lens a little bit, these periods where they've been working really hard on these problems and then, you know, and they don't get anywhere, there's some critical block that they can't quite get over and they put it aside. And it's in that incubation period, as scientists call it, that period where they're not actually working consciously on it, that their creative minds are able to solve it. But in order to access that, you've first of all got to create that downtime where your sort of subconscious can work on it. And then also, there's good evidence that practicing that actually makes you better at unconscious problem solving, which sounds kind of sort of counterintuitive or sort of, you know, sort of hippie California, but it's no more mysterious than our ability to do things like learn languages or recognize faces. We don't know exactly how that works, but we know we're actually pretty good at it.
Well, so to get the benefit of that incubation period where your default network is, you know, working on the, chewing on the problem while your mind want walking or exercising, doing whatever, you still got to put in some work, like some actual work. What does the research say about like how much you actually need to work so that you can actually be productive?
Right. So at the daily level, most of us are capable of like doing really hard, sustained, creative or cognitive work for about 4 or 5 hours a day. And that's in bursts of like 90 minutes or so. And then we need breaks in order to just recover, you know, recover our attention, recover our energy. And once you move past that, there is always, you know, like letters that you can answer or sort of low intensity cognitive work that you can take on. But the core of your day is that 4 to 5 hours of really serious head, sort of heads down time. Now, what really creative people who have a lot of control over their schedules are able to do is alternate, kind of break those up. So you do like 3 or 4 hours, and then you have this period where you go off and you do something that looks totally unproductive. Go work in the garden, go for a long walk. But what's happening actually is that you've got unsolved problems that are still kind of running around in your head when you go out on the running trail or wherever. And while you're out there, your subconscious keeps working on these even while, you know, you are, you know, working on your mile split time or you're admiring the trees and the clouds. And so by constructing days where you're layering these alternating periods of work and rest, you're able to both sort of work better and sort of work in a more sustainable way and do better work.
What I like about rest is you find all these historical examples of great thinkers and creative people who kind of counterintuitive, like just sort of they fell upon this. Like they kind of figured it out on their own without the science. What was interesting with the how much they worked in a day, most of them like worked 4 to 5 hours tops. That's it. And then after that, they would just go garden or walk. Like, you know, Charles Darwin, wake up, he'd work 4 hours and then he'd just go for a walk the rest of the day.
Yeah. You know, and Darwin got a lot done. It's pretty amazing. I mean, what these people realized, like 100 years before consultants today who talk about like maximizing attention and energy rather than maximizing time at work, or, you know, athletic trainers who talk about the importance of rest time, you know, and sort of, you know, sing the praises of, you know, intensive workouts with breaks. People like Darwin kind of discovered on their own that this was a great way to work and a great way to be able to do the kinds of work that they really loved to do.
And with these insights that, you know, if working 4 hours a day of concentrated work and then using the rest of the day to rest and sort of decompress and let that default network system do its work. What does that have to say about our current work setup where it's like 40 to 50 hours a week?
You know, I think what it tells us is that if we were really interested in creating environments in which people could do their best work and be most creative, most sustainable, most productive, we would organize the day very differently. I mean, for one thing, you know, the office would not be like the carnival of distraction that it so often is today. You know, with open offices, with Slack channels and email and Messenger, or the kind of office culture in which it's okay to interrupt people with the one quick question that turns into, you know, a 15-minute diversion that throws you completely, you know, that sort of makes you lose track on sort of the essential thing that sort of that you were working on. I think the workday would also probably be shorter. That, you know, an 8-hour day is not necessarily one that is going to yield the best results either for individuals or for organizations. And it would also be the case that we would build in more time for sort of better rest outside of work, that we would have better respect for the boundaries between work and personal life. And in some cases also build in for things like sabbaticals, slightly longer periods of time off where people can really not just recharge, but like completely change out the kind of mental batteries that we draw upon when we're working. So, you know, unfortunately, we are beginning to see some companies that are experimenting along these lines, right? That are playing around with focus time at work, with playing around with the work week, or that have implemented sabbatical programs for, you know, not just for top employees, but for everybody. So, you know, we're starting to see some pushback against the culture of overwork, but, you know, it's early days with that yet.
So yeah, how do you convince your boss to say, hey boss, I only need to work 4 hours a day?
Right. You know, I think there's plenty of science that that backs up that claim. I think that first of all, you got to talk about what else you can do in the day in order to make those 4 hours really as incredibly effective as, you know, as they could be. And I think it's also, in the study that I've been doing of companies that are shortening their work weeks, it's actually having bosses who recognize the value of this themselves, who've, you know, been professionals for 10 or 15 years, who've run companies, who have faced burnout themselves and have a sense that maybe it doesn't have to be this way, who are the ones who are most enthusiastic when people bring up the idea of shortening the work week or playing around with working hours, who see both, you know, the benefits to it, but also see the possibility that this is, you know, this is not just a crazy idea, but it's something that is achievable and can deliver benefits.
We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. Texas Pete is the sauce that allows you to sauce like you mean it. Each Texas Pete sauce is packed with a bold, balanced flavor. The signature tanginess is what makes it a legendary hot sauce that can be used on just about anything. You're definitely going to want to try every flavor. The original hot sauce has a famous secret blend of fermented peppers. Their hotter hot sauce is 3 times hotter than the original, and it's not for the faint of heart. They also got a flavor called Sabor by Texas Pete, adds authentic Mexican flavor, and they also have a dust dry seasoning that matches the flavor of the original hot sauce in a flavorful dry rub. But the flavor that I've been enjoying lately is the chopped sriracha sauce. It's got chili, garlic, and some tropical tangy notes. It's really good. I love putting on my eggs. Texas Pete, sauce like you mean it. Visit TexasPete.com and use the store locator to find Texas Pete products as well as purchase sauces and get recipe inspiration. And you can use promo code PODCAST24 for 20% off at TexasPete.com. That's PODCAST24 for 20% off at TexasPete.com. Check out the Sriracha Cha Sauce. It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy to follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code manliness to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code manliness. Check it out today. If you're like me, you've probably signed up for subscription services, but then you forgot about them. I'm talking about newsletters, streaming services, things like that. Well, with the personal finance app Rocket Money, it can help you find and cancel your unwanted subscriptions. It can also monitor your spending and help you lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. I had a chance to use Rocket Money, connected it to my checking account, and it found a bunch of subscription services that I forgot about. I was able to cancel them, and I was able to save a lot of money because the stuff adds up. Besides canceling your unwanted subscriptions, Rocket Money will even try to negotiate lower bills for you, up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. They'll deal with customer service for you. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/manliness. That's rocketmoney.com/manliness. rocketmoney.com/manliness. All right, picture that thing you've always wanted to learn. Now picture learning it from the person who's literally the best at it in the world. That's what you get with Masterclass. This year, learn from the best to become your best with Masterclass. Masterclass offers over 180 world-class instructors, and a lot of them are former AOM podcast guests. So for example, you can learn The Art of Negotiation from Chris Voss. We had him on the podcast. Leadership from Jocko Willink, another AOM podcast guest. Writing from Malcolm Gladwell, another AOM podcast guest. You name it, Masterclass has it. With Masterclass, you get unlimited access to intimate one-on-one classes with the world's best. Plus, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk. So I did the Masterclass with Chris Voss on negotiation. Very well done. He talks about tactical empathy, how to mirror somebody so that you can develop rapport with them. So if you enjoyed that podcast I did with Chris Voss several years ago about his book, Never Split the Difference, you're going to love this Masterclass. And right now, AOM listeners will get an additional 15% off an annual membership at masterclass.com/AOM. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/AOM. Masterclass.com/AOM. Check out the negotiation class with Chris Voss. And now back to the show.
One thing you note in Rest is that a lot of these highly productive, prolific writers, thinkers, one of the things they did, so they got the most out of that 4 to 5 hours they were working, is that they had a very meticulous morning routine. Mm-hmm. You know, what was it about the morning routine that bolsters creativity and productivity? And are there any like routines from, you know, people you highlighted that stood out to you?
Right. You know, I think that, you know, mornings, first off, I was amazed at how many people, including like people who engaged in some fairly sort of self-destructive activity and pharmacological experimentation, were still, you know, really meticulous about and disciplined around their morning routines, right? Ernest Hemingway, even though he was a notoriously heavy drinker, was up at 6 every morning writing. And the thing is that mornings turn out to be amazing for deeply focused and kind of solitary creative work, not so much collaboration. But, you know, I found when I was started writing trade press books, that I do my best writing between 5 and 8 in the morning. And I'm someone who in college never started homework until Letterman was done, right? But it turns out there's a quality to those early hours that isn't found any other time. And for those of us who aren't natural early risers, the fact that you're a little bleary actually makes you a little bit more creative. It's like the door to the subconscious stays open a little bit longer, sort of because you're working against your chronotype. But to get, you know, however, in order to get the most out of it, I think people do two things. And one of them is that they set up as much as possible the night before, right? You don't want to have to make any decisions about what to wear or what to work on first or, you know, which coffee to have. You just want to like set all that up so that you can focus on the stuff that really matters and give yourself the most time to work on your most meaningful stuff. And the second thing that it turns out sounds counterintuitive, but is really valuable, is to stop work the previous day in mid-sentence. Like, don't go to the end of the chapter, either conceptually or literally if you're a writer, to stop in mid-sentence. And this makes it easier to get started in the next morning, but it also encourages your creative subconscious to keep thinking about the end of that sentence and to think about kind of the next paragraph and the next problem to be taken up. And so in a way, what you're doing in the early morning is kind of harvesting work that your creative mind has already kind of prepared for you.
Yeah, Hemingway did that stop mid-sentence tactic.
Exactly. No, you know, and so many writers do this, you know, whether it's Raymond Chandler or Dickens, or it turns out to be a really common practice. And, you know, for some people, it's mainly about not having to face the existential terror of the blank page first off, right? Finishing that line of dialogue is a little bit like a writing exercise or a warm-up to get you started. But it turns out that there's also some stuff that kind of goes on under the hood of cognition that makes it a valuable practice.
So these guys, they were doing like their hard work first, like the stuff that actually brought home the bacon. Like if you're a writer, you're mm-hmm. writing. If you're a painter, you're painting. If you're a composer, you're composing. And then they would save Hemingway didn't have email, but he, letters. Like they would write letters in the afternoon.
Right. No, you definitely, you know, you do your most important work first. You don't get up at 5 a.m. in order to work on, you know, in order to like clear out your inbox. And I know that, you know, there are examples of people in the business world who get up early so that they can see what's going on in the market in, you know, some other country. That's really kind of a different thing. That's more like time shifting in order to get, you know, in order to arbitrage some sort of advantage. And while that's something that works in sort of in those worlds, for creative work, it's really about giving yourself time, undisturbed time when no one else is up, to work on stuff that really matters to you.
All right. So do the hard stuff first. Don't finish it. Like, leave a little bit unfinished so that your brain, your unconscious can work on it. And so you can harvest that the next day. And one thing that these guys, a lot of these guys who were prolific writers, thinkers, et cetera, that what they would do when they took a step away from whatever they were doing, their work, they'd go on, a lot of these guys just walked. Mm-hmm. What is it about walking that makes you like come up with ideas?
Well, partly it's simply the physical act of moving stimulates creative thinking. We don't know exactly why walking is valuable as opposed to just being out in nature or being wheeled around in a wheelchair. And there are actually people who have compared to the creative benefits of walking versus being pushed around someplace. But it turns out that sort of that there is something about walking that sort of stimulates sort of those creative juices. Now, it's also the case that exposure to nature or to kind of non-office surroundings also does provide a little bit of a benefit. But I think for most of us, you know, walking is something that we can do easily, naturally. It doesn't take a lot of, you know, special equipment. So we can move very quickly from our desk to this other mode. And the fact that we can move quickly from that one mode to the other, I think also makes it a little bit more likely that our minds are going to keep turning over the thing that we were just working on, the problem that we hadn't solved yet, and make some progress on it, even as we are, you know, doing a couple circuits around the park.
So yeah, a lot of famous walkers include Darwin. We mentioned Darwin, Kant. A lot of philosophers were walkers. Mm-hmm. I guess it goes back to like Socrates and like those guys walked around while they're philosophizing.
Oh yeah. No, that was, the sort of the peripatetic philosophers were walking philosophers.
Yeah. So they grasped that idea that creative ideas come when you're walking. I thought that was interesting. The studies they did where it was like, they compared treadmill, like indoors, and then just walking outdoors. And there was no, like you could walk on a treadmill and you still get the same benefit.
Yes. No, there's virtually identical benefits compared to being out in nature. And so that's the indication that there is some creative stimulus specifically to walking, and in particular, walking at your own pace. If you've got to walk really slowly or really quickly for you, then the benefit gets hindered a little bit. I think mainly because you've got to think a little bit more about keeping up with the person or group that you're walking with.
And like, again, like I think the point that you made this in the book too, is like walking is something you want to do when you're not doing that highly focused work. Cause I think a lot of people hear this like, oh, walking's creative. I'm going to get a walking treadmill desk and then walk all the time at the office. No, like you got to do that 4 hours where you're just, you know, writing and just super intense, and then go for a walk to recover, take a break.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I think that trying to mix deeply focused time with leisure time is going to end up ruining both of them. These are both bright, vivid colors, but, you know, don't swirl them together.
One of my favorite chapters is where you look at the career of Dwight D. Eisenhower, particularly as a time in Europe when he was Allied commander, about the importance of completely taking time off and not even thinking about really important work. And this is a guy, again, he's overseen a world war, yet he still made it a priority just to get away from it all. Tell us about that, because I thought it was really interesting.
Yeah. So, you know, when Eisenhower goes over as Supreme Allied Commander, he's based in London. He's got to both organize, you know, American efforts in Europe and also deal with our British allies and others. It's an incredibly demanding, challenging job. You know, some of it's politics, some of it's strategy. It's long 18-hour days. And Eisenhower is a guy who was never really that comfortable dealing with, like, you know, aristocrats and fancy stuff. He always was a lot more comfortable in, you know, kind of humbler surroundings. And he discovered very quickly that he needed to get away regularly from all of that in order to like be able to do good work. Actually, George Marshall, his commander, pretty much told him that he had to figure that out or he was going to get replaced. He found a place called Telegraph Cottage, which was a little house sort of outside London, no phone. Actually, nobody except his immediate senior staff even knew where it was. So it really was a getaway for him. And whenever he could, he would go down there on the weekends. You know, they would sort of eat very simple meals. He would go for long walks. It was beside a golf course, which he really liked. And so it was a chance for him to completely detach from the challenges of the war. And I think what it teaches us, first off, is the power of detachment, right? The fact that he didn't take work there, that it was basically invisible both for security and kind of political reasons, meant that he was really completely able to put his mind elsewhere and to just get some serious rest and recovery. Another thing that it teaches us is like the power of having this kind of rhythm of work and rest, you know, not just 2 weeks vacation, you know, every year, you know, that you might or might not get, but these regular alternations of work and rest, whether it's during the day or the week, is really amazingly beneficial. And I think, you know, and then finally that, you know, no matter how important you think your job is, probably winning, you know, it's probably not as important as winning World War II. And if Ike could do this, then, you know, I think maybe we should all take a step back and think about whether this kind of rest is something that could make our work and our lives better.
Yeah, and the other thing that stood out to me, he had complete control of what he did there. Mm-hmm. Like, he did what he wanted. He played golf. He read cowboy novels. He'd even cook for himself.
Yeah.
Is that something he wanted to do? So that it comes back to that autonomy. Like, he took control of his rest and what he did.
Right. You know, and that sense of control is something that's really important as one of the things that helps define rest, right? I mean, control is never something that most of us dislike having, but, you know, when you look at things like really serious hobbies that busy people have, things like, you know, Winston Churchill, for example, was a pretty good amateur painter. Eisenhower was too, for that matter. But, you know, you see people who are like really serious sailors or rock climbers or, you know, or musicians. And one of the things that defines, that makes that work, that makes that stuff a pleasure, is that it's a space in which you can exercise some control and exercise some skill. You know, Churchill talked about painting as being great because it was like politics. So for him, it was in both, you needed a clear vision of what you wanted to do. You had to be strategic in your use of resources, but he had complete control over what went into his paintings. You know, he didn't have like the Labour Party standing over his shoulder, criticizing his choice of color and trying to erase his clouds and, you know, and fill in their own stuff. The painting was completely his in a way that made it really, really valuable an escape. And so I think that, you know, particularly for people who are in challenging jobs or that have, you know, and work that has a lot of uncertainty about it, having those kinds of hobbies, that time that is yours and that you are in control of, is really critical for maximizing your, you know, maximizing your recovery and for, you know, simply maximizing your enjoyment.
Yeah, that was another interesting chapter where you talked about the different hobbies some of these people had. And again, it goes to that idea that rest isn't just sitting around watching Netflix necessarily. Rest is actually can be very active.
Right.
So Churchill painted, Eisenhower played golf, he painted, you know, Einstein famously, you know, he played the violin. A lot of scientists are like, oh, who was it, Feynman? He was like, he did magic or something like that. Mm-hmm. Like, so they all,
right. He did magic. You know, he's very famously photographed for the lectures in quantum physics. The cover photo for the author photo has him playing the bongo drums. So, you know, even though he wasn't quite as serious a musician as some, you know, he recognized the value of at least looking like a musician in that sort of, in that kind of context.
Well, another hobby that a lot of these people you highlight in the book take up is exercise. And yeah. I was impressed with some of like the mathematicians, typical people you wouldn't think of being athletes. Actually, a lot of them were serious athletes. Mm-hmm. So what role does exercise play in our recovery from work?
Yeah. You know, that was a surprise for me because growing up, you know, in the South, in a, you know, I went to a high school where athletes and academic kids basically lived in different universes. And so I was really surprised to see how many great minds are also great athletes. But it turns out that, you know, exercise or sports, they provide both a great mental break from work. You know, one of the things about something like mountain climbing is that it is incredibly engaging and you don't think about your work or think about office politics when you are, you know, 800 feet up a sheer cliff. So, you know, you have no choice but to focus in the moment. And that's part of what makes it really appealing for busy people. But also, you know, there are physical benefits that come from serious exercise, but also there seems to be something about sort of there are also psychological benefits, right? There was this amazing study of Southern California scientists looking at their lives over the course of nearly 50 years. And when they started out, this was a cohort that had all come from top universities. They were very promising young scientists. And over the decades, they split into two groups, a very high-performing group, including four Nobel Prize winners, and a second group that wasn't nearly as accomplished. And the thing that separated the top group from the bottom was sports. And it wasn't the bottom group that played sports. It was the top group, right? They were cyclists. They were surfers. They were really serious skiers. And it seemed that taking sports seriously helped them manage their time better. It helped them manage sort of the stresses of work, but it also gave them a certain kind of, you know, a certain degree of kind of a willingness to take risks, right? A degree of resilience, you know, a kind of degree of courage that translated from, you know, sort of the surf at Big Sur or Manhattan Beach to their scientific pursuits as well. And so for all of those reasons, it turns out that, you know, sports and exercise turn out to be really good for you, you know, if you have really serious intellectual and professional ambitions.
Now, you mentioned mountain climbing, and that surprised me the most about, like, I didn't know, like, for example, Viktor Frankl, mm-hmm. he was a mountain climber, had no clue that he was a serious mountain climber.
No, he was, you know, and I mean, Frankl, you know, sort of, Frankl, who wrote, you know, Man's Search for Meaning and spent time in concentration camps. You know, this was a guy who went climbing in Austria where he was from, you know, after the Nazis had banned it, you know, to Jews. So he was really, really devoted as a climber. And one of the things that he said about it late in life was that, you know, you think that climbing is all about strength. And when you're young, it might be, but as you get older, it's something that, you know, basically you can continue to get better at even if you don't get stronger. And he himself, I think, did his last serious climb around like 80 or so. And so, you know, I think that one of the other really cool things I see that inspires me is people like Frankl and others choosing things that are not just physically strenuous, but are also things that they can get better at over the course of their entire lives and, you know, provide a degree of sustenance and restoration that can give them sort of, you know, long and quite happy lives for quite a long time.
You can be productive even longer.
Yeah. Also, yes, absolutely. You know, sort of, I think again, you know, Frankl may have stopped climbing in his early 80s, but, you know, he kept working pretty much right up until the end of his life. And a lot of the people I write about are like that. They have, you know, they publish their last books, like literally the last year that they're alive. And I think there is a lot to be said for envisioning a life in which you're able to work that way. You know, I think we are enamored by the idea of being super successful, super young, right? Making the 30 under 30 list for whatever it is that we're in. But that kind of pursuit of success at a very young age often comes at a really terrible cost. And if you think about what lifespans are like now, you know, it is possible if you stay healthy to, you know, easily make it into your 80s or 90s or probably past 100 now. You have to ask yourself, you know, do you want to peak at 30 and then spend the next 70 years trying to figure out what to do with your life? Or is it better to craft a life in which you can do the things that you love, in which you can continue to explore these areas that you are super passionate about for decades rather than for years? Are there things that you would be able to do, things that you can give the world, that you might be able to give decades from now if only you craft your life in the right way today to make that possible? You know, Daniel Amen Tversky, one of the inventors of behavioral economics, said that people waste years working on the wrong problems because they don't waste hours. You know, and what he meant was that, you know, you need to spend time like just hanging out and going on long walks and talking to interesting people in order to come up with the really serious ideas, the research really worth doing. And I think in a similar kind of way, that if you think a little more about what kind of life you want to lead over the course, not just of the next couple years, but really over the course of the next few decades, then you can, you know, you will set yourself up for a kind of success and a quality of life that can serve you very well and can let you give more to the world than you would be able to otherwise.
So it sounds like, I mean, the first thing that if someone wants to start putting this stuff into practice, some of the things we talked about, the first thing is just be mindful, like actually think about your rest and plan it out. Don't just let it sort of happen to you. Like maybe this weekend you plan out what you're going to do this weekend.
Absolutely. You know, I think the first thing you've got to do is take rest seriously enough to make space for it in your life, right? I think if you assume that, you'll rest when you've got time, right? When you're done with everything, you never will, because we're never done with everything now. And so, you know, actually blocking out time for it, thinking a little bit about what you would really like to do, you know, what stuff really engages you, and sort of giving yourself permission to pursue that with the recognition that it is going to pay off in sometimes very direct and also indirect ways is the first really critical thing. And from that, a whole bunch of other good things can follow in terms of, you know, making better use of your time, you know, being a better planner, being a little bit more ruthless about saying no to things that have marginal value in favor of, you know, having that full day where you can do, you know, the hike to the 12,000 foot peak. So, but it all starts with taking rest seriously and starting to block out time for it.
Well, Alex, where can people go to learn more about your work?
So, well, my last two books are called Rest and Shorter. I've become a fan of really short titles. And my own company is called Strategy and Rest. And the website for that, where I've also been continued writing about these issues, is www.strategy.rest. It's rest is now a top-level domain. And starting in the new year, I'm actually going to be launching a series of online courses that people can sort of get to from the company site. So if you really want to understand how you can put this into place in your own lives and your own companies, start with there and see where you go. And good luck.
All right. Alex, thanks for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. It's been really great.
My guest today was Alex Soonjong Kim Pong. He is the author of the book Rest. It's available on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. You can find out more information about his work at his website, strategy.rest. Also check out our show notes at aom.is/rest, where you can find links to resources where you can delve deeper into this topic. Well, that wraps up another edition of the AOM podcast. Check out our website at artofmanliness.com, where you find our podcast archives, as well as thousands of articles written over the years. And if you'd like to enjoy ad-free episodes of the AOM podcast, you can do so on Stitcher Premium. Head over to stitcherpremium.com, sign up, use code manliness at checkout for a free month trial. Once you're signed up, download the Stitcher app on Android or iOS. You can start enjoying ad-free episodes of the AOM podcast. And if you haven't done so already, I'd appreciate if you take 1 minute to give us a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. It helps out a lot. And if you've done that already, thank you. Please consider sharing the show with a friend or family member who you think would get something out of it. As always, thank you for the continued support. Until next time, this is Brett McKay, reminding you not only to listen to AOM Podcast, but put what you've heard into action.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.